Hey there, everybody, and welcome to the NFL Roadshow post-trade deadline edition. A lot of moves we were thinking might happen. Most of them did not. OBJ, for instance, still on the Browns, much to his father's dismay, one would assume. He posted an 11-minute video to his Instagram on Tuesday, breaking down all the times that Odell was open and not hit by Baker. All the times Baker missed him. Liked a comment from someone about Baker doing it purposefully, just not what the Browns want to see in terms of team chemistry moving forward. So I'll be interested to see how that plays out. And Kimberly Martin from ESPN did report that there were some conversations that happened between the Browns and the Saints, but they couldn't come to a deal. Sounds like money was an issue there. Saints have no cap space with which to work, so that didn't happen. They also stood pat at quarterback, the Saints did, though Sam Farmer reported that Philip Rivers told him he would take their call if they reached out to him. So that's kind of interesting. We were kind of thinking that Evan Ingram might be moved. Packers and Bills in need of a tight end in particular. That did not happen. He's still in New York. Titans did not trade for a running back now that Derrick Henry is out. And I'll be talking to Jim Wyatt, who's covered the team since 1999, about that development a little bit later on in the podcast. He thinks that they are, you should still count on them winning the AFC South, by the way. Another thing that did not happen, Deshaun Watson. Not traded, despite lots of reports in recent weeks that that might happen. Never made sense to me for so many reasons, unavailability being one of them. Obviously, you can't put him on the field until his legal situation is settled, and it's not getting settled in any meaningful way anytime soon. And when I say settled, by the way, in that sentence, I mean resolved, as in we go through the process, we hear both sides, and some sort of legal decision is made about guilt or innocence. The only way that situation was going to be settled anytime soon was if it was literally settled, as in Watson pays the accusers money to make it go away so he can go on with his life. It happens all the time in legal circles. It does not mean that he is guilty or innocent. It means that he wants to get on with his life, and we won't know ever whether he's guilty or innocent. It means that the legal process, the judicial process, will not play out to a natural conclusion. And this is what the Dolphins were reportedly hoping for. According to Charles Robinson from Yahoo, that was a contingency for them. They wanted him to settle the 22 sexual assault cases brought against him so that then they could trade for him. They wanted him to do that so that there would be no legal impediment to getting him back on the field. Which tells me two things are likely true. They don't really care if he did it, and they don't think that we care either. They think that if he gets back on the field and he starts winning and we never get that answer, we all move on and we'll forget that it ever happened. And history tells us that they are right because it has happened before, number of times, and we do forget. And it makes me sad as someone who loves this league and is also a woman and feels slapped in the face with the way that these reports have come about in recent weeks. There is a chance that Deshaun Watson is a victim here. I know some of you are thinking that there could be a conspiracy there in Houston, that they got a bunch of women together somehow to accuse him of something he did not do to make him look bad in a way that would somehow benefit someone else. It is possible. That's what the legal system is for, to suss that out. It is also possible that he did the things that he's been accused of doing. And if he did, and we're just waiting for the legal system, justice system, to run its course, and those accusers are just waiting for a chance to tell their stories and get some sort of resolution, and an NFL team is out there saying, I will sign you if you make this go away. What kind of message does that send to the women that you care about what they say happened to them? That you value them? Of course it doesn't. And by the way, the women in that lawsuit are not the only women who metabolize that message. Women who work with more powerful men metabolize that message. Period. It's why, historically, women have not raised their hands when something uncomfortable or worse happens to them. It's part of the calculation. You say you value me, but your actions show me otherwise. I am not going to put myself in a position to lose more. I know where I am on this totem pole of power. And by the way, it is not lost on me that this message has been sent as we try to figure out what the workplace culture was like in Washington. As they fight to be heard, as they continue to speak up, they are practically throwing breadcrumbs in our direction from Miami. Anyway, that trade did not happen. A few trades did. We saw Charles Omenihu traded from the Texans, of course, to the Niners. Will help on the defensive line for a sixth round pick. Melvin Ingram, veteran outside linebacker for the Steelers, traded to Kansas City, who also got Dan Brown, a tight end from the Jets. He came in a deal that sent Laurent Duvernay-Tardif from Kansas City to New York. The guard, who's also a doctor, wasn't being used in Kansas City this year. Maybe he'll be able to help New York's offensive line. Of course, the big trade this week did not come on deadline day. It came on Monday. Another blockbuster for the Rams, who are making a habit out of this sort of thing, sent a second and a third to Denver in exchange for 8-time Pro Bowl linebacker Von Miller, former Super Bowl MVP, clearly pushing their chips to the center of the table on a Super Bowl run in LA this year. A move that Jordan Rodrigue has written about beautifully for The Athletic. She is an incredibly talented writer and reporter, and she joins me now. Let's break the huddle.
Hurry up, let's go!
2-on-2-on-2, ready? Hey.
Jordan, you used a phrase in your article on Monday that I thought was perfect to describe this move. It was new vintage Rams. What did you mean by that?
Okay, so a little bit of a backstory, Lindsay. And first of all, great to see you. None of you guys can see us. Thank God.
We're seeing each other.
but it's nice to see you. The Rams debuted a new uniform concept this year called that they're calling their modern throwback. And it's a play off the old LA Rams uniforms. And they're really cool and fans really like them. And I was kind of like, oh, don't use the phrase modern throwback. And I was like, what's another phrase that has similar meaning to modern throwback that is not that? So new vintage, I avoided the word upcycled as well, you know, but I feel like this is now who they are. This is the Rams, how they've sort of made their model and determined their space in the NFL to be. Things like this, you see it almost every other year, and certainly basically twice this year in the case of Matthew Stafford and now with Von Miller. And this is how they build. And I know we're going to get into that here in a minute, but this is not something that's going away. And they have, it sounds like to me in my couple years now covering being here and seeing sort of the ins and outs of it, they have the security and the continuity on their staff to be able to take these risks and make these moves because they are able to present the plan and have that cohesiveness. And so this is who they are and who they're going to be moving forward.
I would think that this must be such a fun team to cover just because they're so interesting and they're doing things so differently. And then of course, on the actual field, they're having a lot of success and that's fun to cover too. They're clearly all in on going after a Super Bowl in the immediate future. They're trading away a lot of draft picks to do that. Some would suggest that they are trading their future for their present. Do you think that they see it that way?
I don't think they see it that way, which is a facet of this that makes it so interesting. I think generally the way that they see it is they want to be among the 10 or so teams in the league every year that are considered to be contenders perennially, not just rebuilding and overhauling and then burning everything to the ground and then rebuilding it back up and then maybe becoming contenders down the road or mortgaging on first round picks or, you know, quote unquote tanking, although nobody does that. Yeah. Okay. But like, you know, not doing it that way, being a team, one of the few teams I think in the league and there are others that are built this way. The Rams a little bit uniquely, I think in terms of the model, but teams that are wanting to make sure that they're in the conversation of trying to win it all every year. And so it's kind of funny, you know, you hear all in after moves like this, but it's great. You know, you also heard it in 2019 when they did the Jalen Ramsey trade and, you know, they kind of were still putting pieces together at that time. You heard it, you know, when they traded Jared Goff and certainly heard it now. And I think they're trying to make sure that they are all in on a perennial basis as one of the teams that are competitive in that way. One of the teams that are in that sort of echelon of perceived contenders who are going to be known to make those moves, and then also deal with a pool of other people throughout the league that have had that been made known. And so understand that they are always sort of in the mix of these things. And I think that opens up your sort of ecosystem of what's available to you. And what's possible. And you see this with the really creative terms in terms of the Broncos balancing out Von Miller's salary for the rest of the season. I mean, that's a creative way of doing it. This is untenable. The Rams could not afford Von Miller, even with some of the different contract structures that they did and guys they offloaded, like they still couldn't even come close to affording Von Miller. Right. So you have to get creative in that regard. And I think this is a team that because they don't spend a lot of time ruling out impossibilities and instead spend a lot of time asking, why don't we try this? I think that that is what maybe in their minds is more important than sort of the perception externally about what they are and whether or not this crashes and burns in the future. And I think part of their team build also depends on understanding the parts of their ecosystem that do make this sustainable. And specifically what I'm talking about there are the way that they use the comp picks, the way that they draft and develop talent around core star players, in the sense that they're not drafting in the later rounds looking for complete players. They're looking in the later rounds for players who complement Aaron Donald, Jalen Ramsey, Cooper Kupp, Robert Woods, and now Matthew Stafford. And you can increase your probability and your efficiency rate of hitting on those prospects and those players, especially in the later rounds of the draft, where it becomes more and more of an inefficiency and a toss-up. You can turn that into an efficiency because you are not looking for a guy who can do five things. You're looking for a guy who can do two things. It's just those two things happen to complement what Aaron Donald does, and then developing in that way. So I think the belief in their ecosystem is what in their minds makes this a sustainable model. Winning also helps, of right. course, cannot be, unsaid here, because that also means that the draft picks that they do have, that they trade away, have less value than the sort of quote unquote, like proven commodities that they bring in. And that's a big part of the ecosystem. But the things that I mentioned just previously, they all work hand in hand together. And that's what I think in tandem and in totality, not just one or the other, in totality, that's what makes them believe that moves like this don't make or break the ecosystem. It's all the little pieces around it that work together. That's what sustains it.
Well, and you talk about those picks in the later rounds, which they actually have more of those than I think people think, right? You see them trading away their first and their second and their third. And people are like, oh, they have no more draft picks. They actually end up with a relatively high number of draft picks. They've averaged, what's the number in the last few years?
They picked like 9 times a year on average for the last like half decade.
That's incredibly high. That's incredibly high. So they're just later round draft picks and the comp picks that roll in when they lose players in free agency, that ups that total there. But you wrote a lot, a really interesting piece last year around draft time too, about how they've just changed their entire model of how they approach the combine and how they approach player evaluation. They're revamping that whole ecosystem, to steal your word. Also, they're doing everything differently. What are some of the ways that they're, and you kind of touched on some of it there in terms of the fact that they're looking for people that complement their stars that they've already plugged in. What are some other things that they're doing in terms of their player evaluation that people would find different?
Yeah, it all helps push toward creating, like turning what I think is often perceived as an inefficient pick or total inefficiency in terms of third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh round picks, trying to turn them into efficiencies and sort of advantages, and leverage the math in that sense. It's kind of crazy. Like, it's how Sean McVay built his offense. It's how they're trying to sort of re-energize this defense at this point. It's certainly how Brandon Staley and Sean McVay built the defense last year. It's all about, and it's how they're now, it's how they operate in their personnel department, their front office, like turning disadvantage or perceived disadvantage into mathematical advantages and leverage points, and finding those leverage points. And that's crazy to me. It's like when you and your dog start to look alike, that's what's happening here. Like, all of it's happening, and it's kind of all similar themes being pulled throughout the entire building. And one of the ways that they're doing that is, you know, okay, so you're not allocating certain resources toward an incredibly huge energy and time investment in finding first round picks. Okay, what are you going to do with those resources? No, you're not sitting at home. I think that's the fun thing to say is like, what do their scouts even do? Like, you know, that's the fun joke. Instead, you're reinvesting that time, you're reinvesting that energy into, you know, finding the two of what it was like seven small school prospects were picked last year. The Rams picked two of them and one of them started for them the last three games. And one of them will start for them, you know, a year, 2 years from now. And so finding those guys with late round picks, finding guys who are going to be immediate contributors in certain phases, doing things like building and sort of marrying the way that they use internal data and blend it with the way that they evaluate football players as football minds. That's very interesting. You know, I did a study on their fourth round picks. The fourth round is huge for them. That's probably, if they can find a way to only pick in the fourth round forever, henceforth, that is probably what Les Snead and his staff would want to do because they love the fourth round. And so I did a study on their fourth round picks and they've built this data system called JARS internally that basically runs sort of comparatives and data points and juxtaposes each prospect against each other and runs like sort of compiles almost an algorithmic version of who that prospect is based entirely on data points and then compares them to and projects their, you know, who they might turn into essentially, or
like this guy has the same measurables as Cole Beasley. So he would project to be our Cole Beasley, like those types of things.
Similar to that, but like using data points from like 5,000 evaluated defensive backs to come up with queries that match like only four specific data points. And those also happen to match Jalen Ramsey and Derwin James. And that's how they found Robert Rochelle. And it's just things like that, that are like, they're figuring out how to try to be a step ahead as this big wave of data and analytics sort of sweeps into the league. And you're going to see a chasm opening up between the teams that are ready for it and the teams that aren't, and finding ways internally to ask different questions of the prospects. Internal GPS is a huge thing for them. Finding in this offense specifically, it's so predicated on timing and creating little layers and the screen game and how that unfolds and creating those little moments of specifically timing between the receiver and the quarterback, less so than maybe certain traits that might be, you know, straight line speed, things like that. You know, finding data points, like GPS and measuring that with short shuttle and combining those things together instead of 40 time and short shuttle. You know, how does this prospect move between point A to point B? They found, you know, sixth round pick Jordan Fuller, who started for them for the last 2 years. They found him via GPS data and they matched his GPS data to the film that they were tracking and found that he was rarely, if ever, out of position, even though he ran like a really unimpressive 40 time. And they just threw that out. They like basically printed it out, threw it in the trash can. And he became one of their highest ranked prospects. And they knew that nobody would pick him higher than when they were able to get him, or they hoped. I don't want to say they knew, that maybe gives them too much credit, but they hoped and then they guessed right and they bet right in that example. And so just kind of finding those ways to make the educated guess much more educated than it normally would be. And you know, they miss on guys, and I think everybody does. The draft overall, I think people sort of get pulled down toward the mean anyway, but the way that they're trying to create those small efficiencies where otherwise there would be inefficiencies based on how they use data, how they scout, the time that they reallocate into those processes. I think they think in the long term, not only does that sustain their team build model and allows them to keep trading the heck away all of their picks in the early rounds, but it also continues to sort of like be a part of the engine that makes this thing go.
Okay. So what kinds of things could pop up? Like, what are the things that would break that model? Trying to, you know, since this is a fresh way of looking at it.
Yeah.
Would it be something like an unforeseen injury where now all of a sudden you do have to go draft somebody like that if there isn't somebody that's available in a trade or free agency? Like Matthew Stafford, it was almost lucky for them that if when they wanted to upgrade at the quarterback position, that there was a team in a specific situation that was willing to unload somebody that was actually a viable starting quarterback in the league. That kind of situation is not going to come along very often.
Yeah. And I think to address the second part first, like that was completely fortuitous for them. That the stars aligned in that way, because they were looking at a bunch of different guys who they thought maybe would be tradable. This is before we knew a lot of the stuff that we know now about a lot of guys that we thought would be tradable. Like even Aaron Rodgers, we thought at one point, Russell Wilson, we thought at one point, like guys who we thought maybe, you know, they're doing their homework on all of these guys. Matthew Stafford being in the same place in Cabo as Sean McVay and apparently every other player on vacation at that time. And Brad Holmes and being Detroit's GM and him knowing Jared and understanding that them throwing Jared into the deal also helped to make the engine go because they had their bridge quarterback, sort of all those things meshing. The one thing that I thought was so telling from Sean McVay that he said a couple of weeks ago was that he knew Stafford was going to be good. He didn't know how good he would be. He didn't think he would be this good. And the thing was when they saw an opportunity that was a smart bet for them to make and a logical catalyst to introduce into their system that would take them maybe increase that margin just a little bit for them, they ran toward it. And that's what you're also seeing in this Von Miller trade is they saw a player, not necessarily a need for them, I don't think, but someone who takes them and again, flips some of those leverages in the advantage of the defense and allows them to be flexible with some of their personnel on the back end, allows them to definitely, maybe they hope, free up Aaron Donald a little bit more than he has been. When you're accounting for two plus ones or two on ones in certain situations, you know, it's kind of a nightmare to defend. And so flipping those leverages on that side to them, that advantage, whether or not Vaughn has three sacks, five sacks, you know, whatever, the idea of having him on the field as a mathematical advantage in that way is to them worth the effort and worth the sort of bet worthy catalyst and the smart catalyst introduced in their system. So to your other point, this thing can go off the rails. You know, they're on a high wire, as I wrote in my column. Like if you have an injury, you know, Rams fans, I am knocking on wood right now, like Rams fans don't yell at me, but if you have an injury at a key position like that, then that becomes a problem. They are top heavy as a roster. They do have some young guys coming up who won't be ready for another, you know, year, maybe two. But they have a very, very top heavy roster that does this train sort of starts to skid a little bit. And the wire starts to wobble a little bit. When you see, you know, when you do have something like, you know, some unforeseen injury happens or some such variable that can really set them back in certain ways. And I think they do know that and they understand that. And that risk does not to them outweigh the benefit of what could happen if they try these things and they try to make these bets in this way. But that's a big one. You know, Sean McVay missing on a hire. He loses his coordinators every year. He loses assistant coaches every year, missing on a hire and not being able to develop these players, especially these late round players in the way in which they have depended on and their ecosystem and their model does depend on, kind of being subpar in that way, for 1 year or one season or two seasons, that would also sort of tilt this thing on its head. But they're hoping that's, I like to think it's more scientific than hope, but sometimes it feels like hope. but those are two things that could really upset this. Obviously, winning games is the main thing that makes this thing go. But definitely those are two factors that could put a little bit of a problem into the rails here.
You know, evidence more evidence that it's working, right? Because they're obviously winning games. But I was struck by the fact that Greg Gaines came into the game last Sunday and ended up as the week's highest, had the highest pass rush win rate in the NFL, which to your point about like having these other guys, yeah, you know, and developing them and finding the right guys at some of those other positions, like that's a backup coming into a position and crushing.
Yeah. And it's Greg Gaines. That's a great example, Lindsay. And then, you know, it's John Johnson from a couple years ago. It was Troy Hill, guys who then went on to help them with their compensatory pick formula, or they will in this upcoming off season. Sebastian Joseph Day, 6th round pick, guys who just were, you know, 4th, 5th, 6th rounders who are not doing everything for them, but they're complimenting in the way they need to. You know, Sebastian Joseph Day is among the best players in the league right now in run stop win rate. And he was a 6th round pick out of, I believe a 6th round pick out of Rutgers. and, you know, worked his way up into that role where now you have to account for him. And he's not doing it by reinventing the wheel and trying to be the next Aaron Donald. He's doing it because they've sort of extrapolated the traits at which he wins and sort of crescendoed them in their plan, in their team, in their scheme that they build week in and week out to make sure that, you know, he's not doing things that are outside of himself, that he's doing the things that work in a complementary way, because knowing that if he's successful in doing that, Aaron Donald becomes successful. When Aaron Donald becomes successful within the course of a game, teams need to draw more attention onto him and put more attention onto him, which in turn makes Sebastian Joseph Day then more successful. So it all is just this combination of things that work hand in hand. And to your point, yeah, like these role players, I mean, God, Cooper Kupp, GPS data, right? GPS data king. And, you know, not a high round pick, although Les Snead would argue that he thinks the third round is a high round. So, cause that's usually where they start. So that's usually where they start picking second or third round. So he's like, wheelhouse. That is a high,
I don't know if you want to be picking that high, Jordan.
Yeah. I was like, oh, all right, man, you do you. But yeah, like, you know, he's breaking records right now. He's, you know, it's crazy.
I know his on pace is crazy. Yeah. Right. Like we're just going to shatter Calvin Johnson's right. Like, okay. Cooper Kupp. No one saw that coming.
Sure. Why not, dude? Yeah. Like, and it's just things like that where they didn't build a bunch of things for Cooper Kupp that he can't do. They built things into their offense that he does well. Same with Robert Woods. They didn't try to, you know, build things around these guys that maybe they aren't good at or aren't comfortable doing. They put guys where they feel like they will succeed and they flood the lane with that. And they do that in a way that's complementary to the traits these guys have that they identify in their pre-draft and draft process.
It is fair. We're talking a lot about their draft strategy. It is fair to say that they do not value first round picks the way that we have historically in the NFL, correct?
I think they do to a point, but that point lies on the other side of where they're winning games every year. So because they're winning games that puts them in like, you know, 12 and below every year, that they're winning enough games that makes them pick would then make them pick in the bottom of the first round. The value drops off sharply enough to where those picks then become better as trade capital in their minds, because they're then not drafting unknown commodities, players whose projections you can have all of the data you want, but you still can't truly know who a guy is going to be. And I think history shows us that a lot of times, you know, you look at certain classes and sometimes it is a toss up after, you know, pick 12, pick 13. And so they study that and they think, okay, we established this. I'm still trying to find out what the pick point is. I don't know what it is. That's been like a year and a half in progress of me trying to figure out what is the pick at which you see a value drop off, right? What's the latest you would be cool with picking in the first round? Still haven't gotten an answer to that, but
nope, they're not giving that information away. That's proprietary information.
It's so simple. I know it's somewhere like middle, upper middle, right? So it's like after that, those picks become, especially when bundled, become commodities to certain other teams that they sort of target teams. And I think the Broncos are a good example of this, a team that does need to have those picks at a certain point because they will need to build at some point in the future. And they'll need to overhaul certain things at some point in the future. So those trade partners become very reliable to the Rams as well, because the Rams have something that they necessarily don't value in that way because they don't believe they're ever, you know, in a rebuild at all. And then the other team, you know, you saw this in Jacksonville, you definitely saw this, you know, Denver, you see it in Detroit. The other team has a player who is a proven, not just a good player, a player who they believe would have been, or it was, but is still playing at the level of a top five, top 10 pick, of which they believe they will not have as long as they keep winning games. So that's where you start to see that part of the ecosystem and that cog in the machine sort of rolling as well, because that's very, very important is making sure that, you know, they are not only right in those players. I mean, they were right about Jalen Ramsey being as elite as he is. They were right about Matthew Stafford so far, 8 games in, and actually were proven, I think, more than right, because again, he caught them by surprise a little bit in how much he's able to do in expanding their offense from where it was. And, you know, they hope that they're right about Von Miller relative to what they sort of unloaded in order to bring him in. And in that way, they continue to feel like this is the right bet to make if you keep getting proven right about those players. And that's your body of data that you're working with now. It's a proven skill set, a proven statistical record and history within the league itself, not just in college. You can work with that a lot more safely, I think, in their minds than otherwise.
Totally. I've argued that for years, and I've that I thought if you could get somebody that you know will produce for you at the level that you hope a first round pick will produce for you, why wouldn't you be comfortable trading away the first round pick? And I've had people push back about like duration of career and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And you're getting them on a cheap contract. So in terms of, you know, building around that, then there's value to that. I understand. But if the ultimate goal is just to put a competitive team on the field every year, then it totally makes sense to me. From a Von Miller standpoint, they give up a second and a third, right? And he can become a free agent at the end of the year. Do they need him to re-sign with them in order for that to end up being worth it?
I think, well, ideally, either you win a Super Bowl and maybe he parts ways with them and you still say, you know what, that was fine. We had a gauntlet of quarterbacks to get through the latter, you know, what is it? Gosh, nine games, not eight games, through the latter nine games of the season. And then a playoff run. We had an absolute gauntlet on our way to the playoffs, considering some of these guys who are just stars in this league that they're going to have to get through. And if they get a ring and he still leaves at the end of the season, then, you know, I think that's worth it. If you don't get a ring and he leaves, probably not a great look for them. But even if you don't win a Super Bowl and you can retain Von Miller, which they want to do, and Les Snead just spoke to us, you know, media, actually right before we recorded this podcast, which we totally planned, right, Lindsay? But, right. He spoke with us just now and, sort of confirmed some of the early reporting that I had done on this trade where they had already broached the topic of a long-term partnership with Von Miller. If he can sort of, they have a history, especially when you match a guy with Aaron Donald, and now they've got Leonard Floyd on the other side too, who is, I still think, not talked about enough right now in terms of what he's accomplishing the last 2 years for them. Guys like playing here in Los Angeles. They feel as if they play alongside Aaron Donald, their careers, it's like, it's amazing. They just sort of revive themselves in some way. And not that Von Miller, I mean, Von Miller is obviously, you know, the active sacks leader. His career is not necessarily in need of revitalization, but in terms of extending it past the point of maybe, keeping that window open for himself. I think that's what guys also see when it comes to, you know, the Rams medical team, you know, playing next to Aaron Donald, those types of things, that there is proof, that has happened for players. I mean, Leonard Floyd is 29. So, you know, Dante Fowler was, I think, 30 plus when he came in. So there's proof that this can happen for people. And so I think the Rams are pushing that hard as a selling point in terms of wanting to have something done longer term. Obviously they have like not much money at the moment to even talk about right. that, but projecting against an expanded cap and things like that. I think that's something that Les Snead confirmed too today that they've already talked with his representatives about their willingness to make something happen in that regard. And so I think even if you don't win the Super Bowl, but you then have a guy on a longer term deal, who is producing for you additionally year over year, you know, well past what some may have considered to be his prime years, then I think that you still sort of come out in the green on that trade. And I think that's what they're betting, again, because they're going off of what they know of Von Miller and they've studied him closely. And they're also going off of, again, proven data sets that they have internally of players that they've brought in the past who have been in similar situations.
Well, and if he leaves, worst case scenario, they get a comp pick, and we know how much they love the comp picks.
They love the comp picks. Yeah. There's like a little shrine, you know, tongue in cheek. There should be a little shrine in their offices. And it just says,
are we sure there's not?
You know what? I wouldn't be surprised if there is.
Yeah. Last question. And you mentioned this with regard to Vaughn. And I think that's a really good point in terms of retaining him. Who wouldn't want to play with Aaron Donald? But I think too, in terms of drawing talent, this aggressive approach must help also. And it's something that's hard to quantify, but you're around the guys there on the team. I wonder how much intangibly just having this type of attitude and knowledge that your team is going to do whatever it takes to put you in the best possible position, ways that that might impact a team and I guess lead to them even playing better, you know?
Yeah, you can feel it. I think you started to feel it. I wasn't here the year Jalen got here, but the year that he sort of started entering that path toward captaincy, which he's a team captain now, you started to feel that a little bit. It was already, you know, Aaron Donald's team, you know, Cooper Kupp, Andrew Whitworth, Robert Woods being leaders on the other side of the ball. But Jalen really started emerging as that like kick the door down type of leader. It both in person and behind the scenes, and really had the best year of his career last season. And then sort of built upon that, and sort of was proving that what star power, adding star power of his caliber could do. The Rams went and did it again with Matthew Stafford, who again, like once he started, I remember the day in training camp and it was the red zone sequence. And it was the first time that they went best on best against each other in sort of a live call situation. And Matthew Stafford, threw in sequence. First, he threw a pick. Jalen Ramsey picked him off on like this crazy play. And it was nuts how he even got in position to make the play and then ran it all the way back and then flipped it to Aaron Donald, who then flipped into the end zone. and then on the next two plays, Matthew Stafford went sidearm to Cooper Kupp on the opposite side. And then he stared the next throw. He stared in the direction that he had just thrown the ball to Cooper Kupp and then no look to Darrell Henderson over the top. And that's when I think the team knew, this dude is sick. Like this is star power right here. Right. And so then you started to feel that electricity building and then it built into the season. And so now to your point, like, I do think that there's an energy about these guys in terms of, you know, we are a place that will try to bring in proven players who can win championships or can potentially win championships or who are here specifically to win championships. And they haven't done it yet. But there's a belief there that's sort of starting to build a little bit and a very, I think, internally in that locker room, an emotional maturity in terms of everybody having their role to play and everybody understanding how they complement each other and work in tandem. And I think that is a facet to this, that they are sort of building with that sort of empowerment and autonomy as players themselves. And then when you're a player and you're targeted, when you know that that vibe exists in the building and you're a player and you're targeted in that way, or you're singled out in that way as someone, you know, the Rams in this phase want to bring in, I would imagine that does something for you personally as a player to think, you know, oh, you know, they want me to join this group. Yeah. So I think it's a two-part thing. And I think it's all part of the sort of brand that they're trying to build out there, or out here. And it's, again, just a part of the ecosystem, and it's going to be, it's interesting to watch it unfold. Like you said at the jump, this podcast, never a dull day covering this team.
You will be put in a position to succeed. Now go do your best to make that happen. Jordan, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Lindsay. Always a pleasure.
Jordan Rodrigue, one of the best young football writers out there at the moment, in my opinion. Jim Wyatt, also very talented and very familiar with the Titans. He has covered them since 1999, formerly for the Tennessean, currently for TennesseeTitans.com. As you know, that team is going to look a lot different moving forward as Derrick Henry recovers from foot surgery on Tuesday. And Jim will join me after this to help us understand what that might look like for the Titans.
Hey everyone, it's Brad the Big Noise Evans from the Feed the Noise podcast. From Monday through Friday, catch me and the good sir, Nate Lundy, as we take you through each day's best sports betting opportunities. Whether we're talking spreads, totals, props, or anything else, we will do our Fade 5 to give you the knowledge and confidence to place your bets. Always remember, fade or follow, that's up to you. Subscribe today wherever you get your podcasts or listen on the SXM app, free for most subscribers.
Jim, thank you so much for your time. I know it's a very busy day, so I really appreciate it. How are people handling this new world that they find themselves in there in Tennessee?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you win a game against the Colts on Sunday. That I've covered the Titans since 99, and they've only swept the Colts, you know, three times during that period, and they won a game in Indianapolis where they take a three-game lead in the division, one of the biggest wins, you know, in a long time. And it almost felt like a loss because, you know, Derrick Henry, you find out you know, he's going to be having surgery, had surgery on Tuesday. You know, there's some optimistic reports that he's coming back this season. I think everybody is kind of taking a, well, we'll see approach. And I think the Titans have just got to proceed that, you know, Adrian Peterson, Deontay Foreman, Jeremy McNichols, kind of a cast of guys are going to have to do it without kind of the heart and soul of the team. And so I think everybody's still kind of trying to accept what has happened. And but at some point, you got to move on and get ready to play a football game.
Well, it's, I mean, you talk about the timing of it being bad coming off a big win, and it doesn't feel like there's much to celebrate right now. They're in Tennessee. This is a team that is 6-2 and currently the number one seed in the AFC. And it, you know, feels like there isn't much reason for optimism about the team moving forward. There's been a lot of debate in NFL circles in the last few years about the value of a running back. And I think that Henry has sort of been seen as the outlier in this conversation. In your opinion, having watched this team as closely as you have, how important is Henry to the Titans' success?
Well, I mean, he's kind of their heart and soul. And on days when some other things don't go well, they've always been able to rely on him. I mean, I covered Eddie George. I remember the days when they used to give him the ball 25, 30 times a game. You know, saw Chris Johnson. It wasn't to that same extent. But the Titans have always been a team that has loved to run the football. Derrick Henry's different. I mean, he you know, going for – he was on pace to win the rushing title for the third straight year. You know, on pace to eclipse 2000, you know, he wants the football. You know, he's winning games in September and October when you're really counting your running backs to win for you when the weather turns bad. So he's built for success and they've ridden him. So it's going to be different without him. And, you know, I just got off the phone a little while ago with the team's running backs coach, Tony Dews, and it's a brand new world for him. I mean, he's now having to answer questions about distribution of carries. How much is this guy going to play? You know, what are things going to be like with the offense with that Derrick Henry in it? And nobody knows because it's Derrick Henry has been the offense on a lot of Sundays for the Titans.
So tell me about Jeremy McNichol, because that's the only other running back that is on the roster right now, aside from the two guys that you've already mentioned that they brought in. Darrington Evans was the guy that was on the roster, but he's hurt out for the season on IR, so he won't be a factor moving forward. So what does Jeremy Nichols bring to the table? What does he do well? What does he not do well?
Well, he catches the ball well out of the backfield, and he was, you know, he's a great complement to Derrick Henry. You know, he wants to play. He wants more opportunities, but we just haven't seen him do it in the NFL because he hasn't had to do it in the NFL. And I don't know that he's going to be asked to do it now, because when you're bringing Adrian Peterson, you're bringing him in, I think, to be a part of what you do. Same with Deontay Foreman, you know, a guy who's been in the league for a while, spent some time here in the past. I think they'll try to find the right guy for it. I wouldn't be surprised to see more McNichols early for him, but I think once some other guys get into better shape, get into more of a groove, I could see the things evolve where there may be more of the guy moving forward. There's just a lot of unanswered questions here about how guys are going to adapt to the new offense, what they're going to try to do, and the question mark at receiver is another part of that, because you know, Julio Jones is kind of a forgotten man here. There's a huge trade the team made this offseason. He hasn't been a part of the offense a lot because he's been in and out with injury. So if he's healthy, you know, maybe you don't need to rely on the running game as much because you've got A.J. Brown and Julio Jones, which is the way it was really supposed to be at the beginning.
This week, do you expect that we would see very much Adrian Peterson or Foreman, or will that just depend? You talk about, I mean, obviously they're going to have to figure out the offense and get up to speed. Is that at all something that we should expect to be complicated for them to do in this offense?
It's funny, without seeing them practice, and they'll hit the practice field Wednesday, you know, it's hard for me to envision what they'll do. I mean, I tend to think they know Jeremy McNichols. He knows the offense. He's probably a safer option for you. You know, for the first game, you know, after Derrick Henry's injury, I think once Adrian Peterson gets up to speed, once he gets his conditioning right, same with Foreman, I could see those guys get incorporated even more, but probably going to be a running back by committee approach for at least a little while. And the guy who has the most success is the guy that's going to end up playing the most.
How much pressure do you think this puts on Ryan Tannehill? Ryan Tannehill's looked like a totally different quarterback there in that Tennessee offense than he was in Miami, for good reason. We're seeing it in Carolina with Sam Darnold. You take Christian McCaffrey out of the backfield, and all of a sudden things get a lot harder for a quarterback that isn't one of those types of talents that can make up for deficiencies everywhere on the field. Now that you put Ryan Tannehill back in an offense where you don't have a Derrick Henry to stack the box, it's going to change things pretty dramatically for him.
It definitely is. And, you know, I think nationally, I think Ryan Tannehill maybe gets shorted sometimes, because I do think he has had some really good moments. You know, I know kind of the talk on him is that he can get you the playoffs, but he can't win playoff games when you're going up against other quarterbacks. And he's beaten Patrick Mahomes twice in the last 3 years, both of those games in the regular season. He went to Foxborough and the Titans beat Brady in week one of the playoffs in 2019. They won a game in Baltimore when Lamar Jackson was on the other side. But with all that said, obviously that's when he had his running mate Derrick Henry with him. So it's a fair question, and I think a lot of pressure is on him. I'm bringing Julio back up again. If he can get Julio back and A.J. Brown back, then I think he's still going to be able to be successful. But if you're without Julio and you're without Derrick Henry, then you're asking A.J. Brown to do a lot, and you're asking some other guys to do a lot. And I think that's going to make it hard on Ryan Tannehill. So he needs players around him to be better. He'll have to play better. And then they'll have to be, you know, from a health standpoint, they'll need to avoid any more catastrophic injuries.
Where do we stand on Julio right now? What's going on with him and all these injuries?
People were so excited about him. I mean, it was a huge move. And you know, he didn't do much during training camp, which wasn't a surprise to people in Atlanta, I know. Season rolls around, and then he just has dealt with the hamstring that has had him on the field, off the field. I know he's rehabbing. I think he's frustrated. He wants to be out there, and now they really need him to be out there. I mean, they have been able to be patient with him up until now because they're 6-2, and the running game is going great. A.J. Brown's playing well. Well, now you're going to need all your playmakers to make things go. So I think Titans fans are keeping their fingers crossed that he can get healthy and stay healthy. And we haven't seen that yet.
I've heard some people out there, because one of the things that this will do, I talked about the running back devaluation and the whole conversation about that. And I think that in the next few weeks, we're going to get some clarity with regard to that. Like, how valuable was Derrick Henry for this offense at that position? Obviously, we're going to have a pretty stark sample size to compare Titans with Henry, Titans without Henry. There are some, though, that would suggest that the Titans aren't as good as their record suggests anyway, because their DVOA isn't as high as you would expect it to be for a 6-2 team. How good do you think this team actually was prior to the injury in terms of stacking them up against some of the other best teams in the NFL?
Well, I mean, I have thought watching the Bills from afar that they were the best team in the AFC, and the Titans beat the Bills. I mean, that's a great win. You can't take that away from them. I get people poking holes in the wins over the Chiefs, who
right,
looking a little bit more average now.
Seattle.
Win in Seattle in week two. Maybe that win doesn't look as good. That was with Russell Wilson. And poking holes maybe in some wins over the Colts. So I get that. I still think the Titans are a good team and are still very capable of winning the AFC South without Derrick Henry. I'd be surprised if the Titans don't win the AFC South. Frankly, they're 6-2 right now. They got a 3-game lead. They got the tiebreaker over the Colts. You look at the Colts schedule. They've got some tough games coming up. The Titans actually hit a part of their schedule where things soften up a little bit. So I think the Titans are going to win the division. But the question is how far can they go in January without Derrick Henry? I think this is a good team, but we're getting ready to find out how good, and find out whether they can do it without the guy who's kind of been the heart and soul for you every week.
Well, what you're saying is important based on the timelines that we're hearing, and the timelines are kind of all over the place a little bit, you know, in terms of what's realistic in terms of expecting him to come back. Dr. Mark Addix, who I work with on DirecTV's Fantasy Zone shows, an orthopedic surgeon and a former Super Bowl champion offensive lineman, he has said that their studies show that football players who come back before 10 weeks that have this injury have a much higher rate of refracture. So that gives me pause considering the time frame that that puts them at, like, week two, I think, of the postseason. So what you mentioned, you know, they don't know what the time frame is. What are you hearing in terms of what's realistic and what's not there in Tennessee?
Well, Mike Vrabel does not do timetables. And he said that again and again earlier this week when asked about it. And the reason why is because I don't think he knows the type of guy Derrick Henry is. And, you know, if he's got people saying he should be back in 6 to 8 weeks, then I think that puts pressure on Derrick Henry to be back in 6 to 8 weeks. Every guy heals differently. Every one of these injuries is different. I hate that knowing Derrick Henry, you know, like I do, I know he probably has in mind to come back, but I think he also is going to have to be smart because, you know, this is his career at stake. If he comes back too early, you know, potentially you do further damage and you have to have another surgery. It's been a long time ago, but I remember Javon Kearse back in 2000 suffered, you know, break of the fifth metatarsal in the first week of the season. And then he tried to come back around week 10 or 11 and just was never the same. He ended up having a second surgery. There's been a lot of changes and a lot of improvements in the medical world since and how these things are treated. But I have seen some of the numbers and, you know, it's kind of hit or miss on how guys can come back and how they can recover. I personally think it's an optimistic view to think he's going to be back and playing this season for the Titans. But with that said, if anybody can do it, it's Derrick Henry because, you know, that hit of his work ethic, just the way he is determined to prove people wrong. And so I hope that happens, you know, for his sake, for the team's sake. But I kind of am approaching it that I don't expect it to happen. It'd be great if it did.
Do you have any concern about whether or not we've seen the last of Derrick Henry the way we have seen Derrick Henry these last few years? There are a lot of people that have just been waiting for the wheels to fall off because of the high usage, the tread on the tire. So now you start dealing with serious injuries like this. Do you think we'll see him back on the field running the ball for Tennessee in the future, that's a realistic expectation for him to continue looking like himself moving forward?
I do. I really do. And I watched Eddie George's decline and that happened in time. And he had a turf toe injury that ended up kind of derailing his time here. And when it was done for him, when it was over for him, it was pretty clear that it was over. I think with Derrick, he hasn't been a guy that's dealt with a lot of injuries. He takes such good care of himself. I think, you know, this is a pretty common injury with athletes. And, you know, he's going to a great doctor who I think will do a great job with him. And I think Derrick is going to be smart about not pushing it. So I think he'll come back when he's ready. And when he is back and 100% from a health standpoint, I guarantee you that he'll hear the doubters and know that people are talking about him and he'll want to prove people that he can keep doing it. I don't see this being any kind of a beginning of the end for him. I think he'll bounce back. And the question is whether that's this year or next year.
Watch him come back and be even better than before, because that's Derrick Henry. If anyone can do it, it is him. Jim Wyatt, big fan of your work. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Lindsay. Have a great day.
Special thanks to both my guests, Jim, who you can find on Twitter, J Wyatt Sports, and Jordan, who is at Jordan with an OU, Rodrigue, spelled just like Rodriguez, but without the Z. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to hear more, please give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, or wherever you get your podcasts. The NFL Roadshow is also available on the SXM app. Free for most subscribers. Just download it today and tap podcasts. For video clips of the show and more, follow me on Twitter, Lindsay_Rhodes. I'm also on Instagram, Lindsay Rhodes NFL. The NFL Roadshow is part of the SiriusXM Podcast Network.
The executive producer is Andrew Emmer. Andy King is the director of sports podcasting for SiriusXM. And a special thanks to SiriusXM's senior vice president of sports programming and podcasting, Steve Cohen. And I'll be back on Friday with a look ahead at week 9 from a fantasy perspective. Hope you'll join me then.
SiriusXM Podcasts.